There is a real connection between the mammary glands connection with coordinating metabolism to the bone tissue. And there was a peptide produced in the mammary gland that goes up during lactation and it enters the circulation and it stimulates bone mobilization, which is a key thing that happens in all mammals when they lactate because the diet simply cannot compensate for that, particularly, you know, once the animal is getting up to peak because they can't keep energy for them, calcium for themselves and make milk simultaneously without going into a low hypocalcemic or subclinical state.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com. More milk and higher conception rates? Contact AHV to take uterine health to the next level. Lalamond Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world.
All right, welcome everyone to this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I'm your host for today, Gail Carpenter, State Dairy Specialist with Iowa State University. I'm joined by Dr. Laura Hernandez from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is a professor of lactation biology. Dr. Hernandez did her bachelor's and master's at New Mexico State University and a PhD at the University of Arizona with Bob Callier, finishing in 2008. She did a postdoc at the University of Cincinnati and has been at UW-Madison since 2011. So welcome to the podcast.
So nice to be here to chat.
You are kind of one of the gurus around calcium and hypocalcemia. What got you interested in calcium in the first place? What struck you about this? Was it calcium itself or was it hypocalcemia or what sparked your interest in this area?
It was a total accident. when I was a postdoc, my main area is serotonin biology. And when I was a postdoc, I discovered there was this link between serotonin and communication with the mammary glands in relation to calcium. And so when I finished my postdoc and was setting up my lab here at Wisconsin, I was kind of, you know, penciling, what am I going to work on? What are my hypotheses? What kind of grant am I going to write? What's the problem I'm going to solve? And I had a clear like direction on my biomedical line, which I do some work there, but less clear what to do on the dairy side. And one of the problems, and at that time, there was new data coming out from Jose Santos and Stephen LeBlanc. They'd done several large studies showing that there were these associations with health disorders in these early lactation animals, repro, energy, et cetera. And so I was like, that seems like a good place to start. I have some data that suggests serotonin is tied to calcium. And that's kind of where I jumped in.
All right.
It was totally by accident. So I came at it because I was looking at the mammary connection with governing homeostasis in a lactating animal. And I had some hypotheses surrounding that. And that's where I started and now spend a lot of time there still.
Introducing Ultrasorb R3.0, Volac's comprehensive and complete solution to reduce the negative impact of naturally occurring toxins on ruminants. Ultrasorb R3.0 is a species-specific product designed to mitigate the effects of specific mycotoxins in the gastrointestinal tract of ruminants. Ultrasorb R3.0 also offers lipopolysaccharides binding capabilities. Endotoxins such as LPS can contribute to inflammation in ruminants, with energy partitioned to mount an immune response instead of production. Learn more about Ultrasorb R3.0 at volac.com.
So what was, when you first... You've done a lot of work that has shown there's that connection between serotonin and calcium. But what was the lead that you were going on at the time?
There is a real connection between the mammary glands connection with coordinating metabolism to the bone tissue. And there was a peptide produced in the mammary gland that goes up during lactation, and it enters the circulation and it stimulates bone mobilization, which is a key thing that happens in all mammals when they lactate, because the diet simply cannot compensate for that, particularly, you know, once the animal is getting up to peak, because they can't keep energy for them, calcium for themselves, and make milk simultaneously without going into a low hypocalcemic or subclinical state. So we were seeing that. And what I saw was that serotonin drove increases in the secretion of this hormone. And then we went on to show that it impacts calcium transport into the mammary gland, which drives this negative feedback signal to have more calcium liberated for the mom so that she has enough while also making milk simultaneously. And so that was what we had hypothesized and I'd seen in rodents, both mice and rats. And then we went on to do a bunch of different studies showing that in peripartal cows. And we've looked at how that impacts calcium. And, you know, then, like, I still do a lot of work there, but I started looking at other things, like what does EGTA do? What is subclinical hypocalcemia? Trying to understand what's happening with that connection prepartum that drives an efficient increase in calcium that's normal and allows them to be successful and healthy.
I think of serotonin as like that feel-good hormone, right? It's not immediately apparent to me why that would be connected to calcium function. Like, what's the mechanism there?
Yeah, so that's very common. Most people think of it as feel-good hormone, and actually 95% of serotonin is made outside of the brain, and everyone forgets that. So it impacts a lot of tissues, the gut, the kidney, the liver, the mammary gland, etc. And what we ended up showing is that, so in endocrinology or these endocrine pathways that stimulate hormone function, you have a classic negative feedback driver. So something goes low to stimulate secretion of something else and vice versa. So it's this kind of teeter-totter effect. And so what we were seeing and what even Jesse Goff had seen, like, was that there was this inability for the cow to kind of keep up with the system. Like, she couldn't quite stimulate it at a rapid enough rate to not have that really, you know, 48-hour period where potentially they could have this decrease in milk or in circulating calcium. So I kind of approached it from that way, and what we ended up seeing is that serotonin moves calcium into the mammary gland through transporters to stimulate secretion of that hormone from the mammary gland that then goes to the bone and says, need more calcium, liberate, yes, so that we have enough, help me. So we figured that out, and then we've been working on things, serotonin included, but other things like that drive that response to happen more efficiently. So that the cow has what she needs in order to be successful and not have like a rebound hypocalcemia or a clinical hypocalcemia or a persistent hypocalcemia. And so that's kind of where I've been working a lot since we started by looking at serotonin, and then we were looking at all these different things.
So you mentioned a couple of these different things already, and kind of walk me through some of these other compounds that you're looking at, or hormones, or whatever you want to call them. Yeah.
We were trying to get at one of the things that happens, calcium and phosphorus tend to come together from the bone, but at like a 2-to-1 ratio, so more calcium than phosphorus. And so when looking at various things like DCAD diets or these now exolith sort of diets where they're kind of chelating phosphorus, you have a lot of players in the system and you can't figure out what mineral is doing what. And how all these different diets potentially function to drive something. And for me, I think it's most important that we can tell nutritionists and producers, like, use this product that works the best for you, but this is how it works. So later on, if there's a problem, you know how to actually deal with the problem, because they're not all the same in how they cause something to occur. So we've spent a lot of time trying to understand that. So We've used EGTA, which is a chelator of calcium selectively. So it only binds calcium, and we've done manipulations to look at what happens in the cow there. I've done studies with Exalit, the clay binder, to look at how that product works, because the biology is different than the EGTA. I've done a lot of DCAD studies with a lot of different supplements. You pick it. Like, if you manage DCAD, you know, they're kind of one version of something else. And we've compared all those things, and we've made a comparison to just binding calcium alone, and then how it works in the sense of increasing serotonin itself. And so we've been trying to tease out those pathways so that we then can provide very translational information to producers and nutritionists about what we should or shouldn't do. And kind of some key findings we've had in our work are that, one, if you manage cows prepartum, they do better.
So, wow. Yeah.
It's like, if you manage it, they don't have to go to the doctor most of the time. Yep. Because they're doing the right thing. Whereas if you don't manage them well prepartum, then you're going to the doctor and you have bigger problems. And you're trying to plug holes as opposed to preventing the holes. And so we've looked at that, and we've shown now that these clay binders, while they also increase calcium, the mechanism is very different than a DCAD diet. And that's really important, I think, to understand, because it's more of a phosphorus regulated mechanism. And so giving that cow calcium, say if she does get sick, can cause problems, because it's not likely due to a low calcium, it's a low phosphorus. And some of the responses and the hormonal regulation is different. And I think there's still a lot out there to understand. It's a very new sort of product, and we're still like picking those pieces apart. And it appears there's some different hormones involved, but that still is very like new, and it's hard to say those details, but it works, and it works very well on some farms. Like, there's a lot to take in there, whether there's how your management is, how you feed your cows, how many workers you have. You know, you kind of have to make those decisions. DCAD works extremely well. If you feed it and you know what their urine pHs are, they're pretty predictable in how they respond. That's clearly a metabolic acidosis, and that's tried and true. You watch the urine pH fall within a few hours, they're eating it, and they, for the most part, are fine. And with 5-HTP, or the precursor to serotonin, we see improved calcium, and it looks like it's doing it through its own mechanism, which is related to calcium transfer into the mammary gland. But it predictably causes these responses, and we're still kind of teasing out some of the biology there, and how you would implement it, because right now you have to give it IV because we don't know a lot about what happens in the rumen. And then the EGTA works like what you would hope would be a low calcium diet, which is hard to achieve in the US, but it is very similar to that. If you get calcium low, you increase PTH, you increase calcium mobilization, because that is how negative feedback works. And so we've been working on that, and we've been looking at how that translates to this like sense of transient hypocalcemia. And one of the most amazing things and exciting things that happened in my career is that a lot of the data we were collecting in these super intense studies was very well aligned with Jess McCart's data in these epidemiological studies. And that was so fun to see, like, the epidemiology of a veterinarian and like a very basic scientist come together. Yeah. It was like, yes.
Well, that's how science is supposed to work, right? We got the people really getting into the mechanisms and like nerding out over the super basic stuff. And that's supposed to coincide with the applied side and what we're seeing on a population level. So it's really cool when it's like, yes, the process works.
Exactly. So she and I now have been collaborating on some projects. We haven't published the data yet, but we have a grant together, and we're trying to get at like, what are the contributing factors when you have transient hypocalcemia? Like, what's the level you need what do the animals look like from an immune status, from a calcium status, from an energetic status, from an intake status. And so we have some projects together, and Sabina Mann is also involved. And so we're really excited to see how that all comes together and get it out in the world, because it's been really fun. I would never say it's fun to write a grant, but writing a grant with those two was fun.
I bet. Yes, I'm sure it is. You mentioned a couple terms that I want to pick up on. Transient subclinical hypocalcemia. I think earlier you mentioned persistent, and that does come from some of Jess's work. And I think that's really, when I think about hypocalcemia and some of the issues that we've been working on, to me that feels like kind of the next generation, or the next big thing to solve is the timing of when this hypocalcemia occurs. So can you get into that a little bit for our listeners?
Absolutely. And it's funny, because transient hypocalcemia is scary to people. They're like, but wait, we don't want hypocalcemia. And it's like, that this is like, you have to have a little bit of a decrease to trigger negative feedback. And that's what I remind people. So when I look at those classic decreases in calcium that have been published over many, many years, there are like multiple variables that go into what happens in the cow. Like, it's not in a defined time at like one day that is going to tell you everything. And so it's like the resistance to the drop in calcium, the length of time that they're low, how low they go, and how fast they recover. And so transient hypocalcemia is when you get a decrease to this like subclinical cut point. And we won't argue today about what is the right cut point. There are so many versions of what the right cut point is. But you get this transient decrease that lasts, you know, like 12 to 24 hours. And then there's a return to normal. And then the cow stays normal after that. And that's in that immediate, 24 hours postpartum. That animal is triggering negative feedback appropriately. So they have a decrease, and it's allowing them to stimulate their endocrine systems, like, and the hormones that drive that calcium from bone, so that they can go on and be successful. And those cows are healthier and they produce more milk. And that's what her data has shown. These persistently hypocalcemic cows are low in the time point she looks at. The values are at day one postpartum and day four postpartum, and they're going to be low calcium at both time points. And that's the animal that decreases their calcium but can't recover. And so they're not able to recover from that insult, and they have more health issues. She had several variables she looked at, like displaced abomasum. They produce less milk. And then you have these cows that have a delayed hypocalcemia. So they're fine on day one, but then they go down on day four, and there's something else going on with them. Whether it's a dietary problem, maybe they had hypocalcemia previously or a health issue previously. Sometimes it's that, they've been given a calcium supplement at calving. They just are given one, and they go, their calcium will decrease later because you've kind of just put a Band-Aid, and maybe they didn't have the ability to decrease their calcium appropriately. And so later on they do, because it's not enough to keep them in check because of the endocrine system. And those animals, they really struggle from a health and milk production perspective. And then you have the normal calcemic ones, which are largely okay, but her data suggests that they don't make as much milk as the transient cows. And so it's this appropriateness where you do have to have a decrease to get all the like biological systems going on. And I think, you know, it goes back to a lot of the stuff Dale Bauman did a long time ago, which is showing that lactation is an integrative system. And all the systems are talking to each other, and the mammary gland sending signals. And if you don't allow them to do what they need to do, then you disrupt what happens, whether it's calcium, energy, whatever, pick your thing, right? So that's what these four types of animals she classifies kind of her data into.
I think there's a few things that I like the idea And I use that paper a lot when I talk to students in the classes about the transition period. I think there's probably a few things that we've classically been like, oh, that's bad, right? And then it's like, well, actually, maybe a little bit is good as long as they can bounce back on their own. So like ketosis would be an example. Hypocalcemia, my subclinical hypocalcemia, even inflammation, right? Like, okay, you are in a transition, right? This is a major event that happens. If nothing goes wrong, then you're not working hard enough, right?
Like, right. Right.
But I think to me, the one that does confuse me the most that you talked about is that delayed, right? Like the transient I get, the persistent I get, but the delayed one is the one that I have a hard time like wrapping my mind around sometimes.
And I think there's a lot of variables that could happen there. You know, I think there's like animals that maybe don't eat enough. They don't take off well those first few days postpartum, that maybe it happens that way. You know, maybe there's an event that happens before that, that like gets them off track. As I mentioned, you know, you might be in a place where they're giving boluses or IV, and there's still farms that do that. And so interruption potentially of their own biological system. And there's a lot of things that can contribute to that. And so that is the most, I think, odd type of cow for sure.
Yeah. I think I'm glad you brought up like the calcium interventions. I feel like by and large, the industry has moved beyond like, we're not giving IVs out like crazy unless it's needed. But the bolus is a thing that we have a hard time letting go of, right? Is that something that you've seen as well? And what do you think we should be kind of moving beyond that? Or do you think there's still value?
Absolutely. So I do think it's still a thing that a lot of people use. And I think it takes time for new data to like, and new ideas to be taken up by the industry. And that's fair. It's good for the farmers and nutritionists to be skeptical, because we're doing much more controlled studies than, you know, real life. But one thing that I think, what I would say is that they have their place. If you know that an animal's had an issue beforehand, if they're like projected to be a super high producer, maybe you have third or fourth lactation animals that you're like, I don't know. But in general, if you're managing your cows prepartum really well, they don't typically need it. And so I think that they have a place in the sense of, you know, giving it to animals that like have been sick before in a previous lactation, whatever that is, or they're going to be super high producers, or maybe it's something, or twins, maybe that's a pretty big criteria for like issues at calving, not surprisingly. And so I think judiciously they work. But I think sometimes they go in and you're giving a couple in a very short period of time, and in the time period where they need to have that transient change, and giving it to an animal that's trying to decrease, and then you put it in there, then they are going to come back and go again. And so they still have to have the biological system adjust. So what I've told, you know, people who've called me or talked to me is that I tell folks that still sample a lot and test their calcium. I'm like, give them like 36 hours. If you don't want to wait 48, like give them 36. And if they look fine, they're looking fine, they're feeling pretty good, and you're not seeing any issues in the maternity pen, and you're really worried, like wait until then, because you're giving them that opportunity to get through that time period in which they'll have an appropriate response, or wait until then to test the calcium. Because in that 24 hours, you don't know if they're going up or down. So you take a sample and you're like, they're just fine. And they could be on the going down and they have not hit their nadir. Or they could be at their nadir and going up, and maybe you give them calcium when they don't need it. Or maybe you miss the animal that does need it. And so I've been telling folks to try that. Anecdotally, there was a group that called me from I think they were in Indiana, and he was a veterinarian that talked to me, and he was like, well, I'm wondering about this. I've heard about your work. And I was like, I have never done it with boluses. My work has been with IV and controlled infusion. So take that for what it's worth. And I said, but why don't you give it a try? I said, you're a veterinarian, you're managing the nutrition, like you're going to know, like of all people, you will know. And later on, I heard from him like maybe a year later, and he was like, I said, so how did it go? I hope I didn't like cause you problems. And he's like, you were right. And I said, well, I'm glad it worked for you and your farm. And so that's the other thing is I get that like in a practical sense, sometimes there's folks that want to do it because they're leaving on a Sunday morning and they don't want to come back Sunday night to treat a fresh cow. I get it. There's practicality, but just in thinking through that, like, should I really or should I not? It has its place, but not just prophylactically.
I feel like the pushback that I've gotten when I've talked to people about this is they feel like it's insurance, right? Uh-huh. Like, well, and it's almost like a security blanket. A little bit. Like, this is my emotional support calcium.
Yes.
And the idea is always like, but it's not going to do any harm, right? But I think some of the research that's been coming out in the last 5 years shows that maybe it's not actively hurting them, but it might be holding them back when it comes to production or taking off in lactation.
Right. And they're expensive. So when they're putting all the pieces together, like, you know, thinking through that is worthwhile. And I know, I know Jose Santos had a pretty good data set. He used a lot more than the, like what it says on the label, but there's some good data out there that kind of discuss some of these, limitations. So.
Elevate animal performance with Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg & Schmidt.
So what do you, I told you what I feel like is the next frontier. What do you think is the next frontier when it comes to hypocalcemia stuff?
I think now we're trying to understand better that intersection of like how maybe calcium and hypocalcemia really interact with like inflammation and reproduction and energetics, because there's this, you know, what's been called the iceberg effect. So if this actually happens, does it truly cause this stuff? Or is it just the insult that makes them more susceptible? How much of low calcium really is tied to those like inflammatory like situations? How, you know, critical is it to increasing in feed intake? And I think that we've looked at all these things in a vacuum for a long time. And so I think there's good researchers out there trying to understand really like what's cause and effect, and what's correlation, and, you know, how intricately are they tied together? And I kind of see that going. I also see need to further understand like what are those silicate clays doing and the biology surrounding that, just so that there's more information for nutritionists and producers and understanding the biology there, so they know how to manage the cow later, because the mechanisms aren't the same. So I think that's another important thing that's there. And personally, of interest to me is, because I'm still trying to figure out how I would do this. It's something that Jess and I talk about at times, is how can we prove what's happening to the bone? Because in a dairy cow, it's like, how are you going to get them in a micro CT or a DEXA? They're too big. And it's a question I get, like, how are you going to prove this? Like, it's happening, and Jesse Goff has written about it, but how do we actually get as to what's happening to their bone structure? And I have questions about that and like long-term health in the herd and welfare in the herd. You know, what's happening to their bone structure, and how might these things relate to like their feet and mobility, and how might we assess that with the tools that we have? Because I do it all the time in rodents, but that's easy.
A little bit smaller. Yeah.
but in a cow, that's hard. And so I've been trying to think through that in ways we might do that, because I think there's opportunities with these like computer vision things that are out there that might help us with understanding these biology outcomes and doing it in a way at a larger scale in many more animals, so we have more repeatability of our work in the physiological sense as a really basic scientist. So I have interests in that too.
Well, with that, if there's somewhere that people want to go to be able to keep up with the work that you're doing, because it sounds like you've been doing some cool stuff and it sounds like you have some cool plans too. So is there anywhere that people can go to kind of keep track of what you're up to?
My postdoc does a good job of keeping my papers up to date. But all my like dairy cow related work, we tend to publish in the Journal of Dairy Science. I'm going to put a plug for that because I'm the incoming editor-in-chief starting in January.
Okay. Yeah.
So keep an eye on that. And JDSC, I have to plug both our journals, that the impact factors keep going up. So we hope to keep that going. So certainly there, we keep that up to date. I'm on LinkedIn. I also am on Instagram if folks want to kind of keep track of what we have going on, because I do a lot of different things in dairy land. So, calcium is a big part of it, but I do a lot of other stuff too. So
it's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergenschmidt Animal Nutrition. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Exalit, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Maximize profitability and herd health with early detection in animal health, reproduction, and feeding. The most advanced bolus technology and professional support from agricultural experts make this possible with SmaxTech, the health management system that future-proofs your dairy operation.
Very cool. Well, unfortunately, we're gonna have to bring this conversation to a close. But before I do, we have three questions that we ask all of our guests. The first one, and you may have maybe already answered this, but the first one is, what is your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
Certainly, like, JDS and JDSC, but I like to, I have lots of books about different mammals and lactation, so those are always fun, but I do like the book Milk. It's like a nonfiction book that talks about the evolution of milk as a food. And I like that because I like to teach about it in classes, because it talks about how milk became a food in history. And I think it's fun to remind people like the importance of milk and its products and the value it has in our diets. And that it wasn't just like some random thing that happened as of recent. So I really like that book a lot. The author wrote a book called Salt too. But yeah, so it's a really good book. And I go back and read it from time to time.
All right. So what is your favorite non-dairy related book or resource?
Oh, non-dairy related book or resource. I read a lot of things. I'm not really sure. I spend a lot of time in PubMed these days, but I like to read a whole plethora of books. Like, I read a lot about women's health because I'm a mammary gland biologist. And so I read a lot of books there. But I spent a lot of time just reading a lot of different books, and I spent a lot of time reading a lot of different papers because I try to understand how different systems in the body connect to each other. And I think that's really critical as a lactation biologist because they're all talking to each other. So I'm trying to learn more about the inflammatory system and other ranges of tissues. And so that's kind of where I spend my other time. And I read a lot of fiction books to clear my brain.
So what's your favorite book that you've read this year? Maybe that's a simpler question to ask.
I'm trying to think, I'm going to look on my phone because I keep track of them in Goodreads and I always forget the titles of things. I've been pushing myself to read more, for fun. My husband says I'm too serious. Remarkably Bright Creatures. I just finished that.
I've been seeing a lot about that one.
It's a really, really good book. And it's interesting because it talks about how brilliant octopuses are. They actually are. But it's also a really good book about humans. So I really enjoyed that book a lot.
All right. I'll have to bump that up on my list then. And I'll have to connect with you on Goodreads. I'm also a Goodreads user.
Yes. So. My sister talked me into it. She was like, you should keep track. And I was like, okay. I've made it a goal as a way to clear my brain and not be focused on my job all the time.
I think it's so fun to see what other people are reading too. What your other friends are reading. And yeah, I really enjoy that app a lot. All right. So our last question is what do you think sets successful dairy professionals apart from those that are not successful?
I think listening to other people's opinions. We put out a lot of information and we all have our own kind of school of thought. And I think taking that in and kind of synthesizing the information and talking with producers is really important because I have a lot of ideas, but the way I apply things as a scientist is thinking about the end user, whether that be a dairy producer or a mom in the clinic. And I think translation is really important. So I think the really successful people take that information in and they can also take the criticism about their own work and adjust. Because we're all here to do that. And I think that's really important. And the really successful people I see do that, they seek out collaboration and they intersect with each other rather than keeping it all to themselves and always trying to make it their dogma rather than more of a group thought process. Because I mentioned it earlier, but one of the coolest things was I was talking with Jess. I'd known her a long time, but we were at a conference and she and I were sitting there going through data while other people were talking. And she was like, look at this. And I was like, look at this. And we were they match.
Yay!
and to see that happen, really was awesome. It felt good to me that I wasn't off in some detail, basic question. That I wasn't just doing that, but that my work had relevance. And so to see that come together was awesome. And so I really enjoy that thing. And I see that that's who the people doing good work are open to those ideas rather than being in their little tower of thought.
Have you read Think Again by Adam Grant?
Oh, I have.
Yes, that's something. Yeah, as you're talking, it's reminding me of this book. Yeah.
And I think that's it. And science has become more collaborative. And I think it's a good thing because we all bring different things to the process.
Yeah. Well, it's a great note to end on. So with that, thank you, everyone, for joining us for this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I was pleased to be joined today by Dr. Laura Hernandez. Thank you, Laura, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent with APA Time Zone Hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.